Say Winter Song and choreographer Bill T. Jones thinks of Schubert's Die Winterreise and the bleak landscape it conjures.
And this bleak landscape takes me back to a day when I was in fourth grade, looking out on a snow-covered highway.
What Bill T. Jones saw that day, more from our series Winter Songs, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Today at 4 p.m. on WNYC.
The New York Times recently published John Branch's three-part series, Punched Out, The Life and Death of Hockey, of a Hockey Enforcer, about the professional hockey player Derek Bogard, who is famous for being one of the sport's most feared fighters. Bogard died on May 13th. He was just 28 years old, and when his brain was examined, it showed signs of damage caused by trauma. John Branch joins us now, along with Alan Schwartz, who now covers education for the New York Times, but when he was a sports reporter for the paper, his coverage of concussions was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Also with us is Dr. Robert Cantu, neurosurgeon and co-director of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine, and I'm very pleased to welcome you all to our show. Hello.
Thank you.
Hi, Leonard.
John, there's a story on the front page of today's Times sports section about Pittsburgh Penguins player Sidney Crosby, perhaps the NHL's biggest star, being sidelined indefinitely due to concussion symptoms. Do you think this is a sign that concussions are finally being taken more seriously?
I think it's the latest in a number of signs by the NHL. I think they have been actually pretty good about concussions for the last few years. They've probably turned the corner more than some of the other sports leagues. I think the blind spot for them might be the fighting.
Although we'll get later to some of the things Gary Bettman has said recently about fighting in the sport. Robert, researchers asked Derek Bogard's family for his brain after he died. What did it look like when they examined it?
Well, he had moderate chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It was certainly not as severe as in the brain of Reggie Fleming, and somewhat comparable to the degree that was seen in Rick Martin. So it was definitely there. What was most striking about it was there in a 28-year-old who, if his brain had been, if he'd lived to the age of 70-plus like Reggie, his brain probably would have looked similar to Reggie's.
Now, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, I'm going to call it CTE from now on because it's hard to say the other thing. Is that related to concussions?
Not concussions per se. It's related to head trauma, and it's most closely correlated with total volume of head trauma. Concussions are kind of the poster child for it, but we have individuals in the center whose brains have been studied that have CTE with no recognized concussions. Doesn't mean they didn't have any, but they didn't have any that were recognized.
But I've also heard that epilepsy can be caused by brain trauma, but we're not seeing epilepsy, are we?
We're not seeing epilepsy in most of these individuals. Interestingly enough, in the world's literature, there are epileptics with chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
The brain looks similar to an Alzheimer's patient's brain?
Well, it shares similarity in the sense of the hyperphosphorylated tau protein deposition, but it doesn't share the location of it. In CTE, the location is primarily the superficial two layers of the six-layered cerebral cortex, whereas in Alzheimer's, it's the bottom fifth and sixth layers, much deeper layers. And in CTE, it's primarily the temporal lobe. Alzheimer's doesn't have that predilection. Alzheimer's also has another kind of protein called beta amyloid that we don't see usually with CTE. So they share some similarities, but they share many more differences.
But one similarity is that they can only be definitively diagnosed after an autopsy. Why don't brain scans pick up this kind of damage?
Well, we certainly hope one day they will, and our prospective studies that are currently ongoing in people at high risk for CTE, looking at biomarkers and multiple imaging modalities, is trying to do just that. But as of you and I talking today, there's no imaging study, there's no biomarker that is precisely accurate for determining CTE.
Alan, are enforcers the hockey players most vulnerable to CTE?
Well, we don't know that yet. All we know is that the more head trauma you have, the more likely it will be for you to develop this disease. Now, it isn't guaranteed by any means. There are other factors that will need to be present, and whether they are genetic or otherwise, we'll soon find out, thanks to the work of Dr. Cantu and others. But to try to parse out which players, which styles of play are more or less vulnerable would be to miss the main point, which is it's how many shots you take to your head over your lifetime.
Although there are different reasons for taking the shots to your head. Sidney Crosby, I mentioned, a superstar, he would be hit a lot because he is carrying the puck and he's likely to score and you're trying to stop him. And then there are the other guys like Derek Bogarts who are enforcers. Are enforcers the what are their roles? They're not out there to score, are they?
No, typically not. Their role is basically to be a type of bodyguard for the rest of the players. When people see the other guys are being roughed up, they sit there on the bench and act as a bodyguard.
What made Bogart a good enforcer? Why did he even wind up in that position?
Sure. First of all, he was big, and even as a kid, he was big. And he didn't really see himself in that role until he was about 15 years old, and he suddenly kind of, against character, went into a bench of the opposing team and started taking swings at the other team. And while everybody else was aghast, the scouts loved it, and they said, "We think with your size and apparently with your temperament, you can be molded into an enforcer."
Because the alternative might have been that he wouldn't have made it.
Absolutely.
Just as a regular player, if you don't score all that well, then you have to find another role.
That's absolutely right. He would have never made it to the NHL any other way.
He seemed to have had conflicted feelings about fighting. Was it the only way that he could have succeeded professionally?
I think so, and I think you'll find most enforcers have conflicted feelings. You know, none of them grow up rooting or hoping to be enforcers. They grow up hoping that they can make the NHL and the glory of goals, and they find out at some point along the line, usually as a teenager, that that's not going to happen. So they find a different way in.
It's probably not possible to list all of his injuries, but can you give us a sense of the kind of injuries he and other enforcers sustained during a typical career?
Sure. The most notable one is the hands. His parents, in fact, were more worried about his hands as he got older than they were about his head, which I think is common for families of enforcers, at least before the concussions became a bigger deal.
Because of punching a lot?
Because of the punching. Most of the fights he's in, the guys are fighting with their helmets on. And so he would come out, and his hands would never heal from the previous fight. So he would have very scarred, pussed up hands, and they'd then break back open again. Nose injuries, shoulder injuries.
Wasn't there also the stress of having physical confrontations night after night?
There was. And many enforcers, they'll admit it usually after they retire, that they had sleepless nights or they would go to a movie the day of a game and not be able to concentrate.
On the other hand, the fans loved him. He was a crowd favorite, wasn't he?
There's a certain thing about these enforcers that really draws the fans, not only the fights, but the fact that these guys are kind of blue-collar kind of guys. They're sort of these superheroes on the ice, but they tend to be very nice guys, very quiet guys off the ice.
My guests are John Branch and Alan Schwartz, both of the New York Times, and Dr. Robert Cantu, who's a neurosurgeon and co-director of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Doctor, what causes a concussion? What happens to the brain when there's a concussion?
Well, concussion comes from the Latin word concussus or concutere, and it basically means violently shake, and that's what happens to the brain. It's violently shaken inside the skull, either from a blow, most commonly directly to the head, but it can be a blow that's to another part of the body that just whiplashes the head. As a result of the violent shaking, both linear, straight ahead, and rotational, which are twisting forces, are imparted to brain tissue that causes stretching and tearing of brain tissue in some instances. In others, it just causes metabolic disruption.
Now, can those tears ever be healed?
Well, in not every instance are there tears. The metabolic problems, if properly treated, in most instances, we think can heal without any permanent damage or with minimal permanent damage.
Now, there's such a thing as post-concussion syndrome. What is that, and how long does it last?
Post-concussion syndrome just simply means concussion symptoms that have lasted more than a month by one recognized diagnosis or classification scheme, and more than three months by another. So it's basically just post-concussion symptoms that have persisted for a long period of time. you're into post-concussion syndrome, most people are still going to clear up. Sometimes it takes over a year, sometimes as long as multiple years. And then rarely there are cases where they never clear. And those probably had structural damage that we really just can't see.
Well, when we hear about people who have had concussions and wait a while and then come back, are they more vulnerable to serious problems down the road if they have another concussion?
Well, it all depends on the statistics you want to cite. Clearly, the statistics out there, and we're a part of them, would suggest that if you've had a athletic concussion, that you're 4 to 6 times more likely to have another concussion if you come back. But the majority of the people in those statistics are people that are playing in collision sports, so their odds are higher anyway.
Alan, how frequently do fights on the ice result in a concussion?
Well, I think I'll defer to John on that because he's really done all the recent research on it.
I don't think they really know. The NHL has done studies that say that 8% of their concussions come from fights. Now, a lot of concussions are never reported, so I'm not sure exactly how they come up with that figure.
Mm-hmm. Do we know whether certain parts of the head are more vulnerable than others?
Leonard, can I weigh in on that? Because it's really a thrill for me to listen to Alan's voice. He's been such a great chronicler of the concussion issues and CTE and the many, many changes that have happened over the last several years largely are due to him. And certainly John's three-part article was absolutely fabulous. But I sit across the desk from enforcers from time to time. And when I ask them how many concussions they've had that are recognized, they often say a very low number, usually under 5. But when I ask them how many times have they had post-concussion symptoms in a fight, had they seen stars, legs stagger, don't really know where they are, so on, they tell me about 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 times. And they say they never report them to the training staff or the bench because they realize if they do, their job's in jeopardy. So I think the incidence of concussion in enforcers is far higher than the National Hockey League is aware.
Are they or other former enforcers being monitored or treated for CTE? For example, you spoke to some former hockey enforcers, Brett Myers and Todd Federick. Are they out of the game totally?
Yeah, I can speak on those two. Those two are out of the game. Totally. And both of them will say that they either had 0, 1, or 2 concussions that were diagnosed as players, but now they look back and say there were at least 10, 12, 20 that they just never reported.
We just had a very recent episode in football, moving off from hockey.
No, I wanted to get to football because it is a big issue in football. As a Jets fan, some of my favorite players, pass receivers, have suffered concussions and not been able to come back. And this year we have a case where a quarterback has suffered a concussion, and the player who hit him said, well, I really didn't deserve to be suspended for that.
Well, you're referring now to the Cleveland Browns quarterback, Colt McCoy, who last Thursday night sustained what millions and millions of people believed and could plainly see was a concussion on a helmet-to-helmet hit from the linebacker for the Steelers, James Harrison, who's known for his playing with abandon, if you will. And to give you an idea of how difficult it can be to recognize a concussion, millions of people saw it on television. 2 plays later, Colt McCoy was back in the game. Even though there are rules in the National Football League, which Dr. Cantu helped devise, that require that any player suspected of a concussion receive an appropriate sideline assessment, which takes a good 10 to 12 minutes, and only after it's been ruled out may he return to play. And so that means that the Browns must not have suspected a concussion in Colt McCoy's case. It's staggering.
Well, I'm sure that they asked Colt McCoy, how many fingers am I holding up right now? And
that would be in blatant violation of National Football League rules.
And then they asked him, are you feeling okay? Do you want to go back? Yes, I want to go back.
Well, the thing is we are past that era. And I think, Dr. Cantu, I'd want to hear from you on this. I believe we are past that era in a vast majority of cases. There are some cases. Last year, Stuart Bradley of the Philadelphia Eagles went back into play after having staggered, half drunk on the field, Colt McCoy with the Browns. But I think that over the past 3 or 4 years, the respect for handling these situations properly has increased by orders of magnitude. But you still have situations where a Colt McCoy is missed. And the problem is not that he's missed, because that's going to happen. You have the coach afterwards saying, oh, we handled it right. We gave him the tests. Well, no, you didn't give him the tests.
So who should be punished for this? We're punishing James Harrison. Should we be punishing the teams that allow these players to go back, the coaches who send them back in?
Well, Dr. Cantu, you are an advisor to the National Football League Head, Neck, and Spine Committee.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Alan.
You're welcome.
It's interesting, and thank God. I was on the phone this morning, or on the email this morning, with Jeff Pasch at National Football League, their legal counsel. I also received emails, which is what prompted that email, from Senator Udall's aide, Kevin Cummings. And so I can assure you that we've not heard the last of this, because the National Football League is incensed. And they are investigating, including the medical team and medical personnel, and I'm told that people have been dispatched to Cleveland. So I don't think we've heard the last of this.
Now, these players were wearing helmets. Aren't helmets supposed to protect you against this sort of thing? I didn't like that laugh.
Doc, you want to take that one?
No, Alan, I want to start it, but I'll let you definitely have as much time as you want. No, as Alan has so cogently pointed out, helmets are made to a standard to prevent skull fracture and subdural hematomas, and do a darn good job of that. They are not currently made to a standard to prevent concussions, and have a long ways to go if they're going to get there.
Yeah, I mean, helmets right now, people think that they're the first line of defense. They should be the last line of defense. And when James Harrison launches himself headfirst into, whatever he is, 260 pounds, and his helmet hits against the helmet of Colt McCoy, those surfaces are so hard that Colt McCoy's head is going to accelerate at a rate far faster than the brain inside can keep up. It's going to happen every single time,
which is why the tackle
was illegal.
It's a penalty in football to hit somebody with your helmet-to-helmet.
If you are a defenseless player, if you're a running back looking straight ahead, James Harrison can crush you in the head with his head if he so pleases. True in high school sports, too.
We'll take a little break and we'll come back with more on this. My guests are Alan Schwartz, now covering education for the New York Times, but was a sports reporter for the Times and covered the whole matter of concussions and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for that. Also with us, I suspect, another future Pulitzer Prize nominee, John Branch, whose three-part series, Punched Out, The Life and Death of a Hockey Enforcer, just recently ran and has shocked everyone who read it. And the man they go to in this area for medical advice, Dr. Robert Cantu, neurosurgeon and co-director of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine. Stay with us for more. We're back with Dr. Robert Cantu, a neurosurgeon and co-director of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine. Also with us are Alan Schwartz, who did a lot of coverage of concussions, mostly football-related, at the New York Times when he was a sports writer there. He now covers education. John Branch just did a three-part series called Punched Out, The Life and Death of a Hockey Enforcer, about the professional hockey player Derek Bogart, who was famous for being one of the sport's most feared fighters. Now, Derek Bogart was also, his case is complicated by the fact that he was abusing drugs and alcohol, and he died from a lethal mix of alcohol and oxycodone?
Codone, yeah.
Did his addiction mask some of the symptoms of CTE?
Well, I think Dr. Cantu could probably answer that better than I can, but yeah, they did overlap. He was showing some signs of personality changes, of addictive behavior the last couple of years of his life, and so whether those were from the drugs he was taking or from the CTE or a combination of both, I think is tough to tell.
Well, Robert, is drug abuse common among people with CTE?
It is. The medial temporal lobe is involved with a number of functions. One is memory and executive function, and others are emotions. Now, there's impulse control, and also addictive behaviors are housed in the medial temporal lobe. So that's the area that's most damaged with CTE, and so not surprisingly, drug addiction is very common in individuals with CTE.
Well, aren't they self-medicating?
Well, in some cases, yes. I don't think in all cases, but yes. And certainly, I think John pointed that out, that a number of the NHL enforcers were using medications, got on them because of putting up with painful hands and other parts of their body that hurt a lot.
Well, one thing to also I also want to mention is that some of the early changes that CTE, people with CTE experience, memory loss, depression, and whatnot, can also lead them toward the use of other types of drugs, perhaps not painkillers per se, but Adderall, Ritalin, amphetamines, that can help them feel like themselves temporarily. And of course, that cycle builds on itself. There are some well-known football players who I won't discuss here who have fallen into that cycle as well, where the addictions were a byproduct of the depression and memory loss they were experiencing.
Sometimes we hear about former athletes who have become addicts, and we tend to judge them harshly, but should we at least give them the benefit of the doubt and assume that maybe they went to drugs because of injuries that they suffered while playing their sports?
I think it would be compassionate to do so. I think it would also be appropriate to realize that people in other professions end up becoming addicts as well, radio hosts, sports writers.
Well, some only conservative radio hosts.
Yes, exactly.
Bogarts was abusing prescription painkillers like Vicodin, Percocet, and OxyContin. I'm assuming that's because he did suffer a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was introduced to them about 3 years ago through team doctors because of the pain he was going through. And then eventually he got addicted to them and was actually buying them on the street at some points.
I'd actually like to ask Bob Cantu a question real quick. It's something I've been wondering for a bit. And that it seems to me that a lot of football and hockey specifically, a lot of being a player is ignoring pain. It's whether you can just look past what would otherwise cripple the rest of us. And Bob,
manliness is are often questioned when they keep themselves out of a game because they're experiencing pain.
Exactly. But I'm wondering if there's something in the brain that allows a human being to ignore pain better than anyone else.
Well, I think that's a great question, Alan. And I don't know it in terms of as it applies to these athletes. What is rather interesting is that there are football players, without question, and certainly more than most, that can tolerate incredible amounts of discomfort and in the heat of battle not seemingly notice it. And the same is true, though, of other combative activities like prize fighting or mixed martial arts. And when the adrenaline starts going, you often don't feel the same amount of pain that you feel after when the adrenaline wanes.
A listener wonders if there's a risk of concussions in soccer because players hit the ball with their heads.
Dr. Cantu, could you take that, please?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is the recognized amount of concussion in soccer, the recognized rate of concussion in soccer is the same as it is in football, ice hockey, lacrosse, and the other collision sports. It's possible that the total amount of concussions greater in some of those other sports in terms of the unrecognized concussion, but there's a high rate of concussion in soccer. It is a collision sport, and right now the Ivy League has a panel together that has looked already at football, and we're on that panel. I'm pleased to be with them, and we're right now looking at soccer, ice hockey, and lacrosse in terms of how we can reduce the head trauma in those sports, recognizing there's a lot of it in soccer.
One thing that's important to note for the listener is there are different ways to sustain concussion in, for example, soccer. Most people associate soccer with intentional heading. Okay, a vast majority of the concussions in soccer, both boys and girls soccer, occur, if it happens during heading, it's when two players sklonk their heads together while going up for the same ball, or a player hits his head or has whiplash against the ground, or hits his head against a knee. The issue of whether intentionally heading a ball when you are ready for it, when your neck muscles have tensed appropriately, whether that causes concussion or any other issues with one's cognitive function is one that we're seeing some studies come out, but they're by no means definitive. Am I correct, Bob?
Yep, you're right on, Alan, as always.
So when two people collide on the field or on a rink, should they automatically be screened for concussions?
No, but an interesting thing is we were a part of a study in Canada looking at junior A ice hockey, and they put physician observers in the rink itself, and their whole job was just to look at the ice and watch the people play. And when somebody seemed to get up very slowly and possibly have had a concussion, they were to go down between periods and examine that individual in terms of whether they had a concussion or not. And the incidence of concussion that those physician observers found was 7 times higher than the incidence that was recognized by the on-bench medical staff.
And to give you an idea of the difficulty with which Dr. Cantu and other researchers operate, they made the same. His group made the same offer to a youth football league in New England somewhere, saying that we will put certified athletic trainers and other medical personnel at your games, at your practices, just to see how often concussions take place. Free medical care for kids.
I see where this is going.
Oh, yes, you do. And they declined.
Well, Gary Bettman, the NHL commissioner, says fighting in hockey is expected. It's part of the game. Would he be afraid that if the league took a stronger stand on fighting, they might not draw as many fans?
Well, it's interesting. When you ask him about fighting in particular, his first response is it's been a part of the game for a long time, as you said. And his second response, part two of that, is you look at our attendance figures. I think they're at 94% capacity. And he uses that as a gauge to say that there's obviously not much wrong with our game.
Well, Barbara, one of our listeners, left this comment. She said, I've been going to 10 to 20 Rangers games a year for more than 10 years. And last week, before I read the first of the series about Bogart, I whooped and cheered on the Rangers during the fight surrounding Artem Anisimov's goal. And then I read the article on Sunday at the Rangers-Panthers game when Proust got into a fight. I found myself yelling, break it up. Thank you, Mr. Branch, for writing the articles.
That's very kind.
So maybe this will affect some of the fans' feelings about this. But in football, is that even possible? I mean, we're just thrilled when this incredibly athletic person leaps for a pass, comes down with it, and then he bounces on the ground three or four times.
Accidental head injuries are a part of every sport, and it's a part of everyday life. You can fall down a set of stairs. You can fall off a bicycle. Things like that. I think what some people are asking of football is to assess whether it loses much simply by taking certain acts out of the game. Do you realize that high school, that football, there's only one arena in American life in which it is okay to crush a child in the head, and that's if he's holding a football. Now, is that necessary? I don't know. That's for other people to discuss. But football can be many things. It's whatever the adults want it to be.
So in boxing, in the Olympics, people wear headgear, but they don't in professional boxing. Should we be protecting younger people? Are young brains especially vulnerable to concussions and the effects of concussions, Robert?
Well, there's a lot of concern that they are, and I certainly believe that they are, mostly because of the fact that young brains are not myelinated. They don't have the coating on the axons that they will have later in life. The young brains are more plastic. The young brains are disproportionately housed in big heads and are heavier as compared to the rest of the body, and those heads are on necks that are very weak. And so all of that means that a blow to the head of a youngster is going to have more force transmitted to the brain than a similar blow of somebody when their neck is much more developed and they're skeletally mature. So yes is the answer. I'm very concerned about youngsters playing collision sports, and I think we either need to modify the way they're played or consider eliminating them.
Now, I mentioned that Derek Bogart had drug addictions. Was his team aware of them? Was he treated for them?
Yeah, there's a privacy policy with the substance abuse program in the NHL, and probably for some good reasons. When he first went to substance abuse rehabilitation in 2009, the team said he had a concussion. And actually, the irony there is that he had had all these injuries and concussions before, and it was never said that he had a concussion. But the one time they did report that he had one was actually not true. He was actually in rehabilitation.
Well, you write that in 2009, a doctor asked him to come up with as many words that begin with the letter R as he could, and Derek couldn't think of any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had a few symptoms like that where there were times when, and Dr. Cantu mentioned it earlier, where a doctor looked at him and asked him how many true concussions he'd had, and he thought he had had hundreds by that description. He had never really been told what the true concussion definition was.
Doctor, the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine has examined the brains of four deceased NHL players. Have they shown signs of CTE?
Well, all four that we've seen from the National Hockey League have shown signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. We also have brains of two other individuals that did not make it to the NHL level, that did not.
Which adds to the doctor's assertion before that it's likely a lifetime of heavy hits. It's the more hits you have, the more risk you take, rather than one or two acute hits. Because if it was one or two acute hits that caused this disease, they would have found it by now occasionally in the heads of people who had car accidents or other, you know, episodes like that. But they have never found it in anyone who did not sustain a long period of head trauma, up to and including a circus clown who was shot out of a cannon, a battered wife, and an epileptic who banged his head against the wall, a couple of dozen boxers, a couple of dozen football players, that kind of thing. It's never or almost never been found in someone who did not have that history.
And have you examined all those kinds of brains, Doctor?
When you say I think it's very important to understand that the center has multiple arms, including basic science research, clinical research, and then the brain bank. And we're talking about the brains in the brain bank. And they are really examined by Dr. Anne McKee, the world-renowned neuropathologist, and her team, who then we look at the slides that she's prepared. But the bottom line is that I think it's important what Alan just said, because he mentioned people in society who may never have stepped on an athletic field but took multiple head traumas. We see the same CTE in our blast military victims. The second largest group in our center right now, NHL players being number one, but the second largest group are blast military victims from primarily Iraq and Afghanistan. But there are other people out there in society that have had multiple head traumas, and when they've had their brains examined, have had CTE. So this is a problem that's out there. We don't know the prevalence or incidence of it, but it's out there.
Now, we have no time left, but I wonder if there's been a response from the NHL players and others or the football players to your series?
For the most part, no response, other than the Rangers have said to their players, don't talk about Derek Bogard.
The Punched Out, This Life, The Life and Death of a Hockey Enforcer series is on the New York Times website, which includes videos. My great thanks to my three guests today, John Branch, Alan Schwartz, and Dr. Robert Cantu.